Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, zip up your leather pants, slap on the clown paint, and don't forget to eat something light as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
Hey guys, this is Seth Breedlove, and you are listening to Monsteropolis, a show about monsters, anomalies, and legends. On this week's show, we decided to talk with Lyle Blackburn, who has appeared in a number of Small Town Monsters films and is narrating our upcoming Terror in the Skies, as well as Momo, the Missouri Monster. We're talking about his book about Momo. And that book comes out in March. I think he says March 3rd, but you'll find the exact date later in the episode. If you're enjoying the show, make sure you leave us a review on iTunes and head over to the Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter and follow us on those avenues. If you want to send us an email, it's monsteropolismail@gmail.com. Hope you enjoy the interview.
What was the impetus to actually doing Momo as a book? Did that just spin out of Beyond Boggy Creek?
Yeah, I was, you know, I originally wanted to include the Momo story in Beyond Boggy Creek, but the scope just got too big once I realized just how many stories and how much history there was in state. So I had to kind of confine Beyond Boggy Creek to the Deep South, like 10 states, mm-hmm. you know, rather than just maybe what was defined as the traditional South, which may or may not include Missouri, but it was too big to fit in there. And I thought, well, and it's kind of famous, like the Falk Monster and stuff. So I thought, well, let's just try to do a whole book on it, you know, make it more encompassing of Missouri. So, you know, that's why it ended up as a standalone book following Beyond Boggy Creek.
Yeah, that area, I haven't been down to. Louisiana is pretty deep, right? That's like deep southern portion of the state.
No, it's northeast.
Okay. So then that's closer to where I was. So when we were filming in Alton, that was like super surprising to me, because I still think of Missouri as being Midwest, but I mean, you could almost consider that Deep South part of like Illinois as being southern. I mean, the way the geography changes and everything down there, it almost becomes like you're in the South. That was something that surprised me about like the terrain of that area, and then just how wooded everything gets once you're out of that like central Illinois area and then head south down into Missouri. And you know, that was very like super surprising to me how much the terrain and the geography of everything changed.
Yeah, it's strange, because I've always thought of Missouri as the South, but you get up there in that area and it's now you're talking about Illinois and a lot of connections between those two areas. And okay, I think of that as the North. So, you know, yeah, it's somewhere kind of in the middle of that, where, you know, if you get to the Ozarks in the southern part of Missouri, you're, you know, definitely southern and so forth. So it's one of those states that kind of goes in between and is surprisingly southern, like you say.
Walk listeners through what the traditional sort of Momo story is and what that story sort of entailed.
Well, the public story for Momo started in July of 1972, and on July 11th, there were some kids playing in what was essentially their backyard in a small town called Louisiana, Missouri, which is located in the far northeast section right on the Mississippi River. And they lived below a area of land called Marzoff Hill, which is just was basically just a big wooded hill that kind of rises up amid this small riverside town. And these kids were out there playing, a couple of boys, and they looked up to see this creature standing there. It was standing upright on two legs like a, you know, a man, but it was covered in hair. Hair covered its face, and it was carrying some sort of a dead animal. The kids were young, and of course, this frightened them to death. They started screaming and running towards the house. And at that point, their older sister, who was 14 at the time, Doris Harrison, looked out the window and also saw this thing standing out there at the edge of the trees, and you know, got her brothers inside, and they were panicked, and they called their mom and said, "There's some kind of a thing out there in the yard. Get home, please." So she called the father, and he made his way home. You know, quickly, Edgar Harrison, and he checked it out, and that just sparked a frenzy. It was within a short time, other people claimed to have heard strange noises, claimed to have seen a dark, hairy figure crossing the roadways there, and that was covered in the newspapers. And once it hit the Louisiana Press newspaper, which was the local news outlet in the area, it just kind of exploded. And, you know, subsequent stories in, you know, were printed. The local authorities, the police, they organized a search of Marzoff Hill, went up there and combed it looking for any sort of animal. I mean, they weren't convinced this was a monster, so to speak, but, you know, it could have been a bear or something else, you know, something. Even if it was a prank, you know, they wanted to get to the bottom of it. So, you know, this just perpetuated in a very quick frenzy. And then to add to that, about 3 days later, a group of people were standing outside the Harrison's home near Marzoff Hill when they saw streaks of strange lights in the sky, like white, green, orange lights going down. And that panicked the townsfolk even more, because now, you know, they had what appeared to be, I suppose, UFO-like activity in the sky amid the monster reports. And then there was strange noises going on. And then for a time after that, for at least a month, there were sightings not only of the creature, but of strange objects in the sky. So you kind of had a tie-in with, you know, possible UFO activity. This brought a lot of paranormal researchers to the area, mostly UFO researchers, who quickly discovered there was a related string of sightings all up and down the Mississippi River. People describing long-haired apes crawling up out of the rivers and all sorts of stuff. And it bled over into Illinois, which was right across the Mississippi River. So all of that just sort of blew up in the 1972 era, kind of in that area of the legend of Boggy Creek and some of the other seminal and most famous Bigfoot cases. So Momo since then has become just one of those kind of favorites that people always talk about.
Yeah, and I loved not to give away anything about the book, but I love the way in the book you set it within the context of the era of the 70s and how this was sort of like a time when the idea of Bigfoot blending into something like UFOs or other paranormal subjects. I mean, because there's some weird stuff in here that I had no idea about. Like, you're talking about sounds in the woods, but there was like voices in the woods and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's super fascinating because I didn't know about it. And the more I read, the more this reminded me of Minerva, because you had this one family that kind of is definitely your central sort of characters, you know, your the whole story is kind of centered around them. Like, I was surprised how much Edgar Harrison's involved in all the different sightings, but the way other phenomena start getting introduced into this one story really reminds me of the true story of what happened with the Minerva case, because that's the way that was too. You had these UFO sightings happening. You had the Caton family seeing ghost Native American women on horseback in the woods behind their house. And it's just like this really weird, like, stew of paranormal subjects that are happening together. Was that something that was widely reported on at that time, or is that something that you kind of discovered, you know, in your own research into the story?
No, that was part of the original story, I think. And like I said, a lot of the researchers that showed up were not like Bigfoot researchers. They were all UFO researchers from MUFON and groups like that, and Hayden Hughes, which was a UFO researcher out of Oklahoma. And they kind of looked at it in terms of the creature being a possible extraterrestrial. So that was – it was all tied in to the story. And there was a article by Richard Crow, the late Richard Crow, in Fate magazine early on that kind of ran down all these sort of occurrences. And, of course, he included – very much included the, you know, the other phenomenon, the associated phenomenon of the skyward activity and the disembodied voices and all that within the scope of the so-called monster. So that was, you know, and you can't have any of these cases where you don't kind of trace it back in some way to Lauren Coleman. Mm-hmm. And, he has written later about just that era and how all the high strangeness was kind of combined into just one bizarre, you know, twisted set of circumstances. Whereas today we would kind of separate out, okay, there's Bigfoot activity. Now we've got UFO activity. You know, what connection do these have? Back then it was just, man, a lot of groovy, crazy, strange stuff happening. And it was all just lumped in. And, you know, the story of of what to me sounds closer to a Bigfoot was written about in UFO publications at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was very mixed up, and it was, you know, kind of just gave it that really bizarre early 70s, late 60s vibe.
Yeah. How did your approach to writing this one, or maybe it didn't, but how did it change or differ from like how you approached writing the other two Bigfoot books that you've done?
It was really no different. I mean, I come at it more from an angle of investigative journalism than, you know, a Bigfoot researcher. I mean, I consider myself a journalist before I'm a so-called cryptid researcher or cryptozoologist, because, you know, in essence, I'm writing about these stories, which just so happen to be in this genre or in these subjects. But so, you know, I just simply tell the story. Here's what happened. You know, here's my observations as we go along, if, you know, in the times when I was in the town, and just tell the story. And then, like the Beast of Boggy Creek, for example, at the end, I kind of just examine the various theories. I don't endorse any of them. I just say, okay, well, you know, was it a Bigfoot? Here's what pros and cons to it being a Bigfoot. Was it an extraterrestrial? Here's the, you know, thoughts on that. You know, was it just simply some kids playing a prank, as some people have suggested, without proof, you know, and kind of go down those things. And I just, you know, ultimately you can't prove or disprove any of it. And I don't try to sway anybody one way or another. I just tell these stories because they're fascinating and I love the spooky element to them. This was a little different because it involved a lot of UFO stuff, which I haven't written about before, but it's part of the story. And there again, I just cover it all, and it kind of adds a good flavor to Momo. So it's, very individual and very distinctive.
Yeah, it is. It is different because even Lizard Man, those three books, the Beyond Boggy Creek, Beast of Boggy Creek, and Lizard Man, none of them get into high strangeness, really. I mean, arguably consider Lizard Man itself like a high strangeness story, but there aren't really. It doesn't get into like too much into like UFOs or the reptilians and all that stuff. And so this is the first book I've read of yours where you were really getting into like Stan Gordon territory. What is the town's sort of response to the story today?
You know, I usually kind of can gauge it by the librarians in these towns, because they are often the historians and the people who appreciate local tales and culture. And I kind of got a split view of that. One of them seemed receptive and wanted to talk about it. The other just kind of dismissed it. So it was kind of not unlike any of these towns. You've got some of the townsfolk that just, you know, want to blow it off or think it's silly. And you got others that no matter what the real story is, it's part of the culture and they appreciate that. So I found that kind of go both ways. As far as anything to see, there really was, you know, I didn't find any, you know, Momo Burger House or any sort of, like, you've got the Monster Mart in Falk, Arkansas that, you know, was totally all about, you know, the legend of Boggy Creek and all that. Up there, that I didn't see anything that reflected the old story of the monster, you know. But it certainly back in 1972, when it was all going on, the town was very much embracing it. You know, the local business people were running ads with pictures of, you know, hairy beasts and using that to their advantage. And restaurants were having specials, you know, the Momo Burger or whatever. So, you know, at one time they embraced it, but now you just don't see anything about it that I could see.
Did you? And I don't want to get in, like, step into spoiler territory or anything, but like, did you come away from this thinking on a like personally, did you come away with any like personal theories on what was actually going on, you know, around the area? Like the way it seemed to me was almost like Minerva, where something legit happened to the family. And then it kind of just spiraled out of control after that. What was your take on it?
Yeah, I mean, I have no doubt that, you know, people saw what they said they saw, especially the Harrisons, the Harrison kids, when they, you know, and I interviewed Doris Harrison, the girl that was, you know, she was 14 at the time. She was older than her brothers and can remember it, you know, much better. And, you know, there's absolutely no doubt that they saw some kind of a figure, hair covered figure, standing in their yard. Mm-hmm. Now the question is, was it a Bigfoot? Was it an extraterrestrial? Was it somebody dressed up in a suit? All the other things, there's a lot of other credible sightings. And, you know, if it was just the one sighting, you could kind of say, well, sure, it wouldn't be hard for somebody to dress up in a suit and scare these kids. But when you start expanding the scope and look at the other sightings that were occurring up and down the Mississippi River, the other sightings that occurred there near Louisiana, you start to say, there's something more to this. And especially when you look at the incident that happened 1 year before that wasn't made public at the time. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of uncovered by Lauren Coleman. And in that case, two women were driving south on Highway 79. They were en route to St. Louis, and just north of Louisiana there, they stopped at a scenic turnout. It's a beautiful area, you know, farmlands and cliffs and bluffs and the Mississippi River, and they stopped there to have lunch. And while they were eating, they got this, they started smelling this really strong odor. And following that, they saw an ape-like creature come out of the woods. And I mean, it freaked them out. They ran and jumped into their little Volkswagen and locked the doors. This thing proceeded to come up and approach the car and, you know, hang around there for a few moments till it eventually went back into the woods. I won't say all the story, but those those ladies went down and filed a police report with the when once they got to Louisiana, once they got to St. Louis, they filed a report with the State Highway Patrol, and you know they said absolutely this is some kind of a hairy ape-like creature, and they were very close to it. I mean, it was they were locked in the car, and it was standing right outside the car. So I think in my mind, if that was a person in a suit or something, you know, it might have been still might have been frightening, but they wouldn't have been fooled into thinking it was an animal. Mm-hmm. And so once you start adding in these other incidents to kind of support what the Harrisons saw, you can't really dismiss that as easily as a hoax. And sightings were occurring, you know, 20 miles away, 30 miles away, and occurring without the other witnesses having knowledge of that originally. So, you know, once you add all that up, to me, my theory is that, like most of these cases, something was going on. People saw something, but ultimately I can't prove what that is. All I can do is offer support for the circumstances of the sightings.
Did you come across a history of sightings in that area, like even going back to, you know, like I'm really into the historical stuff. Did you find any record of ape or wild man encounters in that area of Missouri?
There wasn't any that I could trace back specifically to that little town itself. Mm-hmm. But if you span out, you know, 30 or 40 miles or go up just – you go up and down the Mississippi River there. If you go up into Iowa or Illinois, yes, you started seeing a history, and you could, you know, dig through John Green's Sasquatch books, and all of a sudden, you know, you could find people mentioning sightings of ape-like creatures that went back 50 years or more in those areas. And, you know, that again builds credibility to the fact that something like a Bigfoot was being seen up there, not just in 1972, but, you know, before and many years before. And you could look back at some of the famous Missouri wild man cases, like the Blue Man. Now, most of that was kind of down in the Ozarks, which is a much more heavily forested area and what seems to make more sense as Bigfoot habitat. But that's in Missouri, and these are, you know, backed up by numerous newspaper accounts. And, you know, over the years, there's been Bigfoot reports submitted to the BFRO or the GCBRO or submitted to local investigators or stuff from Stan Gordon. And you start kind of tying all those together and looking at them as the whole. Yeah, you've got a long history going on up there.
And that's one this story is has long been one of my favorites, and we could probably talk briefly about like the movie or whatever and what we want to do that with that. But the story involves posses, which a couple times actually, which I didn't realize there were at least a couple different occasions where like townsfolk went out, you know, trying to hunt the monster. Like that was something about this that I just didn't realize the scope of how much the Momo sightings were apparently affecting people in the town. When you were in town, did you find anyone or talk to anyone that might have been involved in any of those, like those early posses, or was that just something that townspeople did as like their fun night on the weekend? Like the other thing that I took away from this is that a lot of the people in the town just didn't take it very seriously even then.
Yeah, I've never spoken to anybody that was on that posse. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's funny because like in Beyond Boggy Creek, especially where I was going around discussing these cases, I would start calling that the ubiquitous posse, like the standard thing, because it almost a lot of those old cases, a posse was organized and they'd comb the woods and usually come up empty handed, obviously. But this one, in the case of Momo, was much better documented. I mean, there was newspaper accounts that detailed the whole thing. There was a picture of the guys, you know, it wasn't just sort of some afterword where said, you know, the police went looking for it. It was like, dude, there was 20 people and included, you know, the one of the wildlife officers there in Missouri, as well as the chief of police, volunteers, deputies. And there was 20 guys, and they were, you know, at least they took it seriously. Again, not thinking in terms of, oh my gosh, we got a Bigfoot, but just thinking, you know, something's out there, because we believe our townsfolk when they say they saw something strange. And so, yeah, it was a big deal, and they plunged into the woods. So you had that sort of organized law enforcement search, and then you did have just people coming down there roaming through the woods on their own. Marzoff Hill was just crawling with people with guns because they read it in the paper, and all these yahoos would be like, hey boy, let's get a six pack and get on down there for the weekend. We'll go find that monster. That kind of an attitude. And so, you know, the law eventually had to try to block off Marzoff Hill because, you know, these people were out there shooting stuff. In fact, one of those, you know, vigilante posse shot a bull, one of the some livestock down there, killed it, thinking, you know, he had seen the monster. And so, you know, that could have been a person. So this, yeah, it's just, I love that stuff. It's, I mean, this is like, I mean, could you imagine that today? Like, there was a monster hunt organized in your town. It would just be mind blowing.
Yeah. The sightings, Momo actually, again, like, not to keep going back to Minerva, but the creature description's actually very similar to Momo and Minerva in a lot of ways, because it's got the well, describe, I guess, what people were actually seeing, or the Harrisons saw.
They described a creature that was at least as tall as a grown man. It had dark hair, and the hair was kind of scraggly, hanging down. They said its head was rather large. They described it sometimes as pumpkin sized. And they said they could not see its face because hair hung in front of its face. Oftentimes it's thought that Momo has glowing red eyes, but nobody really described it as such. They just simply said they couldn't see its face or its eyes because its hair on the head was so long. And that jived with some of the descriptions people had in other parts, 20 or 30 miles away, where there was a sighting on the Kuvray River, in which the guy said at first they thought it was a quote-unquote hippie because its hair on the head was very long. But when it crawled up on the bank, they could see that it wasn't a person. It was some kind of an ape-looking thing. You know, Momo, you know, was described as being, you know, not huge or giant and muscular necessarily. People said it was big and it was hairy and, you know, something like a bear, but not a bear. So I gained from that. It was very much like a Bigfoot description, but in this case, the creature had a larger head and it was hairier. Like you get in the South a lot, you get these kind of descriptions where the hair is, you know, kind of rather unkempt. It's long. It can cover the face. You had sightings like that, of course, and somewhat similar to Minerva, somewhat similar to the Boggy Creek Monster, you know, kind of that vibe.
Did the sightings of that particular look, like that look to the creature, did the Momo monster, did those sightings sort of taper off, or are there still sightings that match that physical description?
No, not really. Mm-hmm. I mean, they, you know, all that, the main core of the story took place very quickly, really within a month. And then, you know, as it usually happens, the newspapers kind of, you know, if nothing's solved or whatever, or if you don't get any really dramatic sightings, they kind of drop it. And the rest of the history just becomes scattered, or you have to talk to people in the town to say, well, you know, there were other sightings after that. But you know, I never got any reports or saw anywhere they described it with the pumpkin sized head and stuff like that. That was mostly from the Harrison sighting. as to where that information came from, and perpetuated by the association of this drawing that came from an alien book, a drawing by Hal Crawford, that had this sort of really big-headed look mm-hmm. to it. That kind of became a popular image of Momo, but if you look at the witness drawings, they don't really look like that.
Yeah, I mean, so obviously this is the official podcast of Small Town Monsters. We're putting out a Momo movie at the end of the year. We haven't even filmed this at the point where we're recording this interview. And if people listen to this interview and want to know why I'm not getting more into like evidence gathered and wanting to know about the footprints and all that stuff, it's because the book isn't even out yet. So I think at this point we're just kind of giving you a teaser of what you can expect from the book and maybe a little bit about what to expect from the movie. But the Sam Sheeran kind of did the, it's interesting because it meshes really well with the cover for the book, because Sam did the sort of like classic legend look to the poster. And then your book has a much more like realistic take on Momo. Although I also said to you, I love the like 70s comic book vibe of the cover to the book as well. So, Claudio, right? Did the cover for yours?
Yeah. Claudio Bergamon. He did my Beyond Boggy Creek cover, so naturally, got him to do this one.
Yeah, it's great. So what do you? We haven't even spent much time talking to each other about the movie. What is your? You can tell me and the audience at the same time. What is your dream for the movie? Like, how do you want to see it sort of come out? And you know, as opposed to something like Boggy Creek Monster, or do you want something that's, you know, like, what is your dream Momo movie?
Well, obviously a giant blockbuster by
Michael Bay.
directed by Seth Breedlove.
Oh, yeah.
I think you're the exact right person to direct it. But even if we got a big lump of money, I would say, no, we got to have Seth direct it or no dice, man. Forget that millions.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think, you know, It's kind of good timing, because the evolution of the Small Town Monsters movies and how they've how each one has kind of had its own personality and things like that. It always seems like we read each other's mind, because the way what you come along and suggest for, you know, a style or a way to make it unique is like, yeah, dude, that's perfect. And I think in my mind, kind of really coming back and playing up the 1970s vibe of the story, like I wanted to do on my cover, in my mind is great. And having a tie in with some narration or on screen narration, like the old movies, Mysterious Monsters and things like that. And then having the recreations, because I think, especially in this one, there's some really exciting sightings. And, you know, a lot of the witnesses have passed on. So having some really cool kind of, you know, retro and period piece kind of reenactments would really bring this story to life, because that's really what it was like. That's what was going on down there. That was, you know, the frenzy and the craziness and what was happening to these folks. And I think, in my mind, the right film would be something that obviously told the facts, but also gave you the visuals, just sort of put you in that time period where this was all happening, you know, in the place where it was happening. You know, we would obviously go to Louisiana and we could film some stuff on Marzoff Hill itself, be very accurate, but yeah, that in my mind, that's kind of the movie and the kind of the grindhouse feel and kind of the, you know, exactly where we're going with it.
Yeah, for sure. We wanted to do Momo back almost immediately after Minerva Monster, and at the time we just couldn't get the money together to travel to Missouri. So it was kind of, and it was something where we kept circling around doing it on and off for the last like 2 years, and then finally just kind of hitching the Momo wagon to the Midwest trilogy that we're working on kind of made sense as well. So, so for listeners, the Kickstarter launches a week from a week from now, basically February 7th, the Kickstarter to fund Momo, the Kickstarter to fund Terror in the Skies launches on February 7th, 7 p.m. Eastern time. We're going to do a live Q&A and all that stuff with the SDM crew. Unfortunately, Lyle won't be here unless I convince him to fly up or something. But we'll do a live like launch party. You'll be able to interact with us, ask us questions about the movie and all that kind of stuff. And then Momo will be out early October of this year. So the actual shoot and everything are going to be happening fairly soon. I actually had a meeting yesterday with a costume guy that's working on the Momo costume. So, it's going to be a big STM year for us, and now for Lyle as well, because Lyle's also narrating Terror in the Skies, which is our winged cryptid Illinois movie that'll be out in very early June. So, and by the time you're hearing this, the Terror in the Skies trailer is online. I actually just got word as we're recording this that it's going to debut on Bloody Disgusting. So if you're listening to this, you'll want to watch Bloody Disgusting on Tuesday and Wednesday of next week, and then it'll hit everywhere else on Thursday, the same day as the Kickstarter launch. So, Lyle, thanks for joining me. This is always so weird doing this stuff, 'cause like we're friends and I feel like I have to be professional. It just throws me off. But thanks for joining us here for your first show on Monsteropolis.
Well, thank you, Seth. I really enjoyed it. And I appreciate your professional approach to these subjects. it's cool. I like these casual conversations, and I'm excited about Momo. I want to get the hashtag the year of Momo trending.
Yeah, we got to do that
in the world. And I don't know, man, just having announced the association with the movie and having announced the book and stuff, people love the Momo story. So I think it's going to be one that, it's going to be a big hit, and I'm looking forward to, seeing how the people respond to the book and then the opportunity to work in with the movie.
What is the official release date for the book? Do you have one?
March 5th, I think, is the official release date. So
soon.
I don't know if it'll be up for pre-order prior to that or what, but should be by March. People should get their hands on it, and that's good, because I got a lot of events starting in March, so hopefully I'll have in my hand at events and all that. So
cool. Yeah. All right, man. We'll get you back on after the book's out, and we'll talk about some other STM stuff, because I'm sure there's a lot more to talk about.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com, and is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.